welcome to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley reporting from Washington, D.C. Welcome to another of our weekly programs. Now, today we're going to be putting some attention on foreign policy, the war plans of the new Obama regime, the extreme demagogic imperialism towards such places as Pakistan, Afghanistan, but also Georgia and perhaps others, perhaps the Middle East. And we're also, we're actually going to go back and look at Herbert Hoover. We're going to see how Herbert Hoover stacks up against various economic players today. Well, I'll tell you what the conclusion is. Obama is worse than Herbert Hoover. Similar to Herbert Hoover, one might say, but worse. And indeed, a lot of people surprisingly turn out to be worse than Herbert Hoover, who, of course, his main problem was that he refused to fight the Depression in any effective way, even though he had had it visited on him by Calvin Coolidge and, above all, by Andrew Mellon, the sinister head of the liquidationist school, the guy who wanted to give the Depression free rein. Don't interfere with the Depression. Surrender to the Depression. Capitulate to the Depression, said Andrew Mellon. And he finds people today who repeat the same line in some very surprising corners. Let's just look at the immediate economic situation. Crash and collapse continuing. We have some figures on the European economy this morning. The Germany, the heart of the entire European economy and one of the leading economies in the world, perhaps in some cases the best gauge of the situation for exports. Germany, the worst economic result in four decades. It could be worse even than that, but these are 40 years of statistics, and this is now the worst performance. It looks like Germany is down something like 3.6% in the first quarter of this year. Italy down 2.2%. France down similar amounts. Europe looking very bad. France has lost about 200,000 jobs over a period of months. Obviously, these numbers are not as big as the U.S. totals. Here we're averaging about 500,000 jobs lost per month as we go deeper and deeper into the recession, depression, breakdown crisis, collapse, disintegration. Don't worry about the stock market. Don't pay attention to the stock market. All the Mickeys are saying that there's an upswing in the stock market. I think that has just about run out of steam at the level of about 8,500 and now sliding backwards. And if anybody had the foolish idea of getting into that, now it's time to get out of it. Symptoms of depression, of course, very dramatic in the collapse of the U.S. automobile industry. This has been done systematically by Obama. The goal is to destroy automobile production and indeed to destroy the United Auto Workers. Reactionaries, right-wingers, right-wing radicals can't see this because of their ideological goggles, but they think that Obama is governing in the name of the labor movement and the United Auto Workers. Nothing could be further from the truth. Obama is owned lock, stock, and barrel by Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, the hedge funds, and the parasitical financier oligarchy and elite. That's who owns Obama, and he dances to their tune. When he met those bankers at the White House, right, he said to them, I'm the only one standing between you and the pitchforks. What he's saying is, I'm a very useful employee, gentlemen. Please keep me on. If possible, give me a raise, but do continue to support me. Some of these characters have made a public show of breaking with Obama. Penny Pritzker, of the parasitical Pritzker family, the people who super exploit all the Hispanic cleaning ladies in the various Hyatt hotels, has had some criticisms of Obama. But a lot of this stuff is window dressing. A lot of it actually is a charade. A lot of it is some attempt to give Obama the left cover without which he cannot continue to do what he's doing. Anyway, Obama at the beginning of April, as we know, rejected the so-called reorganization plans of General Motors and Chrysler, at which point he guaranteed that these companies would go bankrupt. Obama drove General Motors and Chrysler now into bankruptcy. General Motors, it's all over but the shouting. The bankruptcy of General Motors, and that will be a real watershed, as the Chrysler one was. The bankruptcy of General Motors cannot be far away. It's a matter of weeks, maybe of months, but it's going to be bankrupt this year. And it's already acting like a company that's bankrupt. Obama did this. Make no mistake. And the goal is to essentially finish off the last wretched remains of an industrial manufacturing economy in this country so that we can live in the pure utopia of a zero-growth post-industrial society where the only thing going on is the creation of derivatives, the securitization of credit default swaps, which is the great obsession of the Summers, Geithner, Orsag clique now running the White House in this regard. And the UAW, of course, will be broken up. People say, oh, look, they're running Chrysler. Yeah, they were given shares of stock, which will shortly be worth zero in a bankrupt company. And they're given one seat on the board, despite the fact they have 45% of the shares. They're getting one seat on the board. They can't run Chrysler. They will go down with it. And when those Chrysler stock shares go to zero, General Motors this week got down to $1 per share, the lowest price for a General Motors share of stock in 75, 76 years. Almost broke the buck. I'm sure there was a desperate operation by the PPT to prop it up that day. And indeed, it may be going below a dollar today. I'm not sure. But you get the idea. Chrysler shares are headed in the same direction. So this is the handiwork of the union busting and, above all, deindustrializing Obama administration. And just think about that old vulture, Paul Adolf Volcker, sitting in the White House and watching the second onslaught of deindustrialization after the one that he masterminded back in the days of the peanut, Jimmy Carter. So General Motors announces this morning that 11,000 dealers will be cut off. These are generally independently owned dealerships in communities across the United States. 11,000 of those, 1,100, sorry, of those dealers are going to be shut down. Chrysler had previously announced approximately 800 dealers being closed. We're up to 1,900. Let's call it 2,000. And let's assume that, as industry sources tell us, that each dealership represents an average of 50 jobs. These are jobs for salesmen, clerical personnel, mechanics, all kinds of people get involved in this. 50 jobs per dealership. So if it's 2,000 dealerships, then we're talking 100,000 jobs destroyed. 100,000 jobs. Gee, I wonder where the zombie bankers are. Where's Pandit the Bandit of Citibank? Where's Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase? Where's that guy Lewis of Bank of America, that staunch defender of oligarchical privilege for the gluttons of privilege over there at Gucci Gulch? They don't seem to be coming forward and lending, do they? Remember, the whole TARP, the whole bailout, was predicated on the idea that if you got the banking system going again, whatever that means, that credit would restart, loans would be forthcoming, and all kinds of companies would be saved. Not happening, is it? Circuit City went down, 35,000 jobs. Here's another 100,000 jobs. So that's another 2 months of losses of about 500,000 jobs per month. And Barkey is doing this. This is the systematic demolition of industry. This is deindustrialization for a complex of reasons. A lot of it is quite frankly irrationality. It's pure insanity. This is absolute insanity. A government that does the opposite of what it should do in every case. When it comes to derivatives production, they want to make sure that derivatives production is restarted so we can have more cancerous, bloated, fictitious values. And car production, of course, something useful that people really need, the way things are set up in this world at least, they want to shut that down. So this is absolute criminal insanity of the Obama regime.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Your host, Webster Tarpley, here in Washington, D.C. Let me call your attention to my latest books that say Obama the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, available at Amazon.com. Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, also available at Amazon.com. And now, in pre-order phase, still Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Worst Financial Crisis in Human History. The paper copies of that are somewhat held up for various technical and other reasons. We apologize to anybody who ordered Surviving the Cataclysm, and you've gotten your electronic copy, so you know what to do, but you're waiting for your paper copy. Please do bear with us. It will be a few more weeks before those go out, but we're in the final stages of that, so be assured we're doing everything possible to get it to you in a timely way. But this is sometimes factors beyond our control do come in. So apologies if you've been inconvenienced by a delay on that, but it will be coming. But if you haven't gotten it, now's the time to order it, because this book is absolutely confirmed. In other words, it is nothing short of prophetic in the sense of the snapshot offered of the U.S. economy in 1999, which is contained in the back part of the book, is absolutely accurate. And the front part of the book is the best programmatic way to get out of a world economic depression. It's the only comprehensive plan that covers just about everything in order to deal with the depression. And, of course, when there's a depression, we want to fight it, don't we? We don't want to capitulate, roll over, surrender. We don't want to be surrender monkeys for a world economic depression, do we? That's not very very rousing. That might even be considered anti-American in some quarters. I think it might be. So we want to fight a depression, and we know how to fight a depression, and we can defeat it. There's no reason to have another generation have their lives ruined by a world economic depression, people telling us that we can't do anything to stop it, and that any action is futile, and that any way to fight the depression turns out to be big government. Well, that's a bad joke, isn't it? But people like that shouldn't be in government. They should go home and cultivate some other form of activity. If they feel that government has no role in fighting a depression, then that's a good reason not to be in government in the present time. So we've gone through the fact that the GM and Chrysler dealerships, about 2,000 of them are going to be shut down at 50 jobs per dealership. It's about 100,000 jobs that are going to be lost right now. Direct guilt of Obama. Obama did this. He rejected the reorganization plans. He threw these companies at the mercy of the creditors. He made some show of calling some creditors, some of the hedge funds involved were too predatory. He wants a kind of a moderate predatory hedge fund consensus. Probably some of these hedge funds were crowding out certain other hedge funds that were closer to Obama, something like this. So 100,000 jobs will go down the tubes. Now, we've also got then the oil price creeping up. The oil price is up about one-third, 35% since December. And for that, who can you thank? Oh, that's Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and the hedge funds acting through the London ICE, Intercontinental Exchange. That's where there are no position limits. There's no margin to speak of. There's no distinction between producers and hedgers, speculators and hedgers. And there's no regulation, right? It's the British free market paradise. Yes, indeed. Margaret Thatcher instituted the free market. And now Margaret Thatcher's free market is coming home to you in the form of a one-third increase in the price of gasoline. Now, it's more complicated because Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, of course, would have gone out of business. They would have been destroyed in the derivatives crisis in 2008 if it hadn't been for Bush first with the bailout, the TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program, and that has been continued under the Goldman Sachs-owned regime of Obama. So the thanks that you're getting for having bailed out Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and this is all done by politicians owned by these companies, the center of evil being in Wall Street, and they're reaching to Washington, not the other way around. they're going to give you a one-third increase in the price of gasoline. Now, how high can they go? Well, the experience last year shows that $4-$5 a gallon is certainly feasible. Maybe they can do better than that this year. Are you going to stop them? Are you going to demand that the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, institute 100% margin requirements? In other words, if you want to speculate, you put up the entire amount in cash. Position limits so that one big hedge fund, one big Goldman Sachs doesn't come in and take over one half of the market, because it's not as big a market as something like U.S. government securities or something like that, which is more liquid. And will you support the institution of systematic discrimination, because that's what it has to be, between a producer and a hedger, people who are in the market because they buy this commodity and they use it and they're shielding themselves from fluctuations, compared to a speculator who is simply in there to rip you off. In other words, vigorous measures against speculation seem to be needed, don't they? Because the free market of Margaret Thatcher is now going to flay you alive. So you're going to have your skin stripped off, and you're going to go down saying, hail to the free market, long live Margaret Thatcher. And don't forget who her two advisors were, Friedrich von Hayek of the Austrian school and Milton Friedman of the parasitical Chicago school, the monetarists. So monetarist free market economics, my. That's what you're going to get now. Let's see how high they can go. Maybe they can make it back to $5. Maybe they can do better. Now, on the other side of the ledger, on the other side of the pond here, we've also got the extension of the bailout, the TARP. I stress this because a lot of Republican demagogues are trying to mix up the words stimulus and bailout. No. Our enemy is the bailout, the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Stimulus, some of that stuff is fine. A lot of it's very fine, just too small. The stimulus is not the big issue. The stimulus is a mixed bag, I suppose. Some things are good, some things not so good. Some things very evil, to be sure. But many things needed, we can go through the list another time, as indeed we have in the past. But the thing you've got to fight is the bailout. The bailout is the big thing, because that's where Barkey's putting all of his money. He's putting, so far, between Bernanke, Geithner, Summers, Orsag, Volcker, and Barkey Obama, they're putting approximately $11.8 trillion into the hands of Wall Street. And that amount grew this morning by what they claim to be $22 billion. I'm sure it's more. This is now a $22 billion for a bailout for the insurance companies, since it's not an industry, is it? It's paper, so it's the insurance companies. We'll be back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Topley here in Washington, D.C. 100,000 jobs lost through the Chrysler and General Motors dealerships. Oil price now up by one-third since December, thanks to the survival of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. They're going to take out that survival on you in the free market paradise set up by Margaret Thatcher under the guidance of von Hayek and Friedman. So those two dead guys are going to take it out on you in the price of gasoline that you pay this summer if you drive anywhere. And we've got the insurance companies, $22 billion of the bailout, the TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program. Personal insult to me contained in the name, of course. $22 billion, who gets this? Insurance companies. The Hartford of Hartford, Connecticut, $3.4 billion. Lincoln Financial Group, $2.5 billion. Allstate Insurance Company, the one that used to be associated with Sears Roebuck, that's in Illinois. Principal, another insurance company. Ameriprise Financial gets some of this money. And the Prudential of Newark, New Jersey, the company with the strength of Gibraltar, except they don't. They need a bailout from the federal government. Now, why do you think insurance companies would need a bailout from the federal government? Same reason AIG did. I am certain we will discover or have discovered. Because of derivatives, because of those credit default swaps, mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, structured investment vehicles, you know the drill, various forms of collateralized debt obligations, anything that represents a second layer of paper, paper based on paper, often in the form of a side bet between two contracting counterparties about what a asset will do, whether it will go up or not, and how much, and all kinds of options that are built in, straddles, knockout, look back, all this stuff. You can read about that, by the way, in the exhaustive list of options, or quasi-exhaustive list, in Surviving the Cataclysm, which you should all order from Progressive Press, www.progressivepress.com. So AIG set up a hedge fund in London, issued $3 trillion of derivatives, and when that blew up, that is the single biggest hit on the U.S. stock taxpayer so far. It's $180 billion, and it will probably get up to $400 billion before we know it, all because of one hedge fund in London with $3 trillion of derivatives. And, of course, the edifice of derivatives, 1.5 quadrillion worldwide, $1,500 trillion of notional value in derivatives. Where did we get the figure? Well, you can look at the Bank for International Settlements website. They estimate something like 1.2, 1.3 quadrillion. So we're a little bit above them because they lowball the estimate. And this is what, as Professor William Black has said in an interview to Truthout, William K. Black says that Summers and Geithner are committing accounting fraud, and what they're trying to do is revive the market for credit default swaps. That is probably the most destructive and the most volatile and the most illegal, really, of all kinds of derivatives. So it's undoubtedly the case that the Hartford, the Prudential, Allstate, Lincoln Financial Group, Principal, Ameriprise Financial, all of these insurance companies have dabbled in derivatives. The official explanation is that these insurance companies hold 18% of the corporate bonds in the United States. So therefore, somehow, if that crashed, then that would be the end of the world. Notice, you're always getting an argument that this or that paper value is sacrosanct, and if you don't defend that paper value, then there will be terrible consequences in the real economy. Even as Chrysler goes bankrupt, lays off tens of thousands of workers, General Motors, tens of thousands of workers, a lot of people losing their health care in the process, pensions up in the air, pensions transferred over to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, meaning the U.S. taxpayer. So the horrible consequence of not supporting the banks is happening all around you all the time, and they propose to go ahead and keep supporting the banks. Now, another dimension of this, there's $22 billion for these insurance companies. Now, let's look at the state of California. So here we have Arnold Schwarzenegger, the clown from the Hippodrome, who comes forward and he says that there's a $22 billion budget gap of the state of California. Wow, what a coincidence. Actually, it's Arnold says $21.3 billion, and the TARP is $22 billion for these parasitical insurance companies. But it's more or less the same. But somehow there's a disconnect. The wonderful Obama regime, which is supposed to be there for hope and change, doesn't seem to realize that their first responsibility is not to a bunch of gunslingers in these insurance companies who have bought toxic, cancerous, bloated, fictitious derivatives, but rather they think that they owe their first allegiance to the insurance companies. And to hell with the people of California. California, of course, put Obama over the top with all those electoral votes, but California not getting too much for their fealty to Obama. And I think that's handwriting is on the wall there. Arnold says California faces a $22 billion budget gap It's the first time since 1938 that they've had a drop of annual income tax collections. So the worst depression in 70 years in California. It's a real depression. It's an honest-to-God, authentic world economic depression. For those who think that this is somehow all the media conspiracy, believe me, it's not. It's a real economic depression. Look at those figures from Europe. You can find other figures from around the world. We now face the leanest of times, says Schwarzenegger. California, for the first time since 1938, faces a decline in personal income. So this has all gotten worse. Even the movie industry, not so great, and on and on. So his plan is basically to lay off about 40,000 state workers. 40,000. 5,000 immediately, and then the rest. How about that? He wants to sell the Los Angeles Coliseum. The New York Times reports that Arnold Schwarzenegger wants to sell San Quentin State Prison, but if you buy it, you don't get the inmates. How about that? That's a real funny joke. You think that you'd be getting them as slaves if you buy the prison. Maybe that's going to be done under the table. So naturally, Schwarzenegger comes forward with a series of regressive taxes, regressive meaning that they cut into the necessities of the poor and they don't touch the luxuries of the super rich. This is the basic principle of tax equity, that you want to have progressive taxation, not proportional, and certainly least of all do you want regressive taxation of the Thatcher variety, right? Let everybody pay a lump sum because that's fair. Well, it's not fair. And that would be the case of user fees, things like that. Those are regressive taxes of the worst sort. So it's going to be about 5,000 jobs lost immediately, and then more and more and more. He's going to have layoffs. Oh, the school year is going to be cut. That is to say, the education of children in California is going to be undercut by this situation with the budget. So immediately Friday, layoff notices go to 5,000 state government employees. The move designed to cut the general workforce by 5%. A disaster. Obama transferred the $22 billion out of the hands of these parasitical insurance companies and into the coffers of the state of California to prevent the breakdown of human civilization in that part of the world. We'll be back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. One other interesting point. Goldman Sachs, saved by your tax dollars under the bailout meaning bailout, stimulus, quite a different matter and much more complex, but pure evil is represented by the bailout. And watch those Republicans. They want to make the word bailout disappear and call everything the stimulus. Very, very tricky, these reactionary Republicans. The bailout for Goldman Sachs, of course, 40 to 50 billion. Actually, they got money through AIG. They're getting money from all different points of view. It's well over 50 billion that you have paid to keep this noxious, parasitical Goldman Sachs going. They were involved in breaking the laws of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in regards to subprime mortgages. Remember, the answer to subprime mortgages is that there shouldn't be any. The adjustable rate mortgage should be illegal. Anybody who is going to get foreclosed on like that should be protected from foreclosure. Indeed, because of the complex situation, everybody should be protected from foreclosure. We should freeze foreclosures, stop foreclosures for 5 years on your primary residence or the duration of the crisis, whichever takes longer. You call that big government? Well, if that's big government, make the most of it. Keep people in their homes and stop the financial predators from destroying the lives of American people and preventing, basically, if you throw people out of their homes, you're disrupting economic life and you're making the depression worse. Now, Goldman Sachs could have been skewered. Some of these bums could have gone to jail and should have gone to jail in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. But they have been allowed to get off with a relative rap on the knuckles, that is to say a mere $60 million fine from the woman who's the Attorney General of Massachusetts. This, again, is the idea of the complete double standard in this society where you have one measure for poor people, you know, the Jean Valjean in Les Miserables of Hugo, right? He steals a loaf of bread for his family. He goes to jail. But the malefactors of great wealth, the economic royalists in Wall Street and in these Connecticut insurance companies and in the various mutual fund offices in Boston, completely different standard applies to them. Now, let's just remind ourselves, Larry Summers, of course, is at the center of this process. We can call him the new Hjalmar Schacht. Actually, we could have a poll. Is Larry Summers the new Hjalmar Schacht? This is the German finance minister, let's say delicately, during the 1930s. Or is he more like Volpi di Misurata? He was the Italian finance minister under Mussolini. But whenever we talk about Summers, we should always remember that Summers is a creature of Rubin, of Bob Rubin over at Citibank. So various people have been supporting Rubin below these last 20 years. And if you supported Rubin, you're now getting Summers, so you're going to deserve what you get. Now, Herbert Hoover is the most hated president in recent American history. Certainly the rage against Herbert Hoover greater than any other in the 20th century. Carter did very badly, but not quite as hated as Hoover. Here's an interesting little book that one comes across. Campaign Speeches of 1932. Campaign Speeches of 1932 by President Hoover and ex-president Coolidge. And what you see in here, of course, is the tragic limitation of Hoover, that he has to pay lip service to this free market mumbo-jumbo. And he's always blathering about the principles on which the U.S. was founded. In other words, the principles seem to be you're on your own. But in many ways, Herbert Hoover is better than a lot of people you find around today, among Republicans, certainly, among libertarians. Because Herbert Hoover, because of the fact that he's in office, right, that the American people simply wouldn't tolerate somebody who sat there and said, well, we've got to let the Depression run its course, right? We're not allowed to interfere with the Depression. That would interfere with the business cycle. We have here the acceptance speech of Herbert Hoover, Washington, D.C., August 11th, 1932. And Herbert Hoover immediately establishes himself as being somewhat better than a lot of these Republicans of today, and certainly we can compare him to Obama in a minute. It turns out Herbert Hoover is actually better than Obama. Here's where Herbert Hoover is better than the Republicans and even some, what can we call them, Austrian monetarists of today. He says, we had two possibilities. Two courses were open. We might have done nothing, says Herbert Hoover. That would have been utter ruin. Instead, we met the situation with proposals to private business and the Congress of the most gigantic program of economic defense and counterattack ever evolved in the history of the Republic. And we put it into action. In other words, he wants to portray himself as somebody who has been actively fighting the Depression. And, of course, anybody in the executive branch would have to say, I'm here to fight the Depression. And then he's had a polemic going with Andrew Mellon. Remember Andrew Mellon, the sinister Secretary of the Treasury, the proto-supply-sider, I guess we'd call him, the guy who under whom Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover all served. Herbert Hoover then speaking in Des Moines, Iowa, October 4th, 1932. He says, some of the reactionary economists, is Hoover talking, so he thinks there are people way to his right. Some of the reactionary economists urged that we should allow the liquidation to take its course until we had found the bottom. And he says, no, we determined that we would not follow the advice of the bitter end liquidationists and see the whole body of debtors of the United States brought to bankruptcy and the savings of our people brought to destruction. Interesting. Now, Herbert Hoover also has a critique of the Federal Reserve System. And he brings this up in the middle of his campaign. Other people seem to attack the Federal Reserve System, but not when they're on cable television or not when they have a national sounding board, a national pulpit. What Herbert Hoover does, here we are in St. Louis, Missouri, November 4th, 1932. Herbert Hoover wants to blame the Depression to some degree on the Federal Reserve, and it's quite true in the sense that the Benjamin Strong New York Fed did act as a tool of Lord Montague Norman, otherwise known as Pink Whiskers. That's what he was called by the Roosevelt people, the New Dealers. Here's what Herbert Hoover says in St. Louis on November 4th, 1932, about the Federal Reserve System. He says, at the time the Federal Reserve Act was passed, it was promised by the Democratic leaders, this is back under Woodrow Wilson, 1913, 1914, it was indeed promised by Democratic leaders at the time the Federal Reserve System was created that they had found the solution to prevent booms, slumps, and panics. I could quote from a multitude of speeches at the time of the passage of this act, and further from the assurance given in political campaigns as to this enormous accomplishment of their party. I find, says Herbert Hoover, in the speeches of President Wilson, Secretary of the Treasury McAdoo, Senator Carter Glass, and other leaders of their party, the Democrats, the recurrent idea that through the control of interest rates and other authorities, the Federal Reserve System would prevent booms and consequently slumps and panics. A few of their expressions are of interest. Now, he quotes from a bunch of speeches by these figures. And they say, back in 1914, we shall have no more panics. Panics are impossible. Businessmen can now proceed in perfect confidence that they will no longer put their property in peril. Now the businessman may work out his destiny without living in terror of panic and hard times. Panics in the future are unthinkable. Never again can panic come to the American people. The whole country, says Herbert Hoover, went along for years with much confidence in these statements. And although no one can say with certainty, it is likely that that confidence contributed to the crash. So Herbert Hoover had a pretty good critique going of the Federal Reserve. He had a polemic against the Federal Reserve. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. I'm your host, Webster Topley, here in Washington, D.C., and we're reaching the, I think we've passed already the high tide of the Obama deception. We're taping this program on the afternoon of Friday, May 15th, and if we look back to the parallel case of Jimmy Carter, we will soon see that Carter peaked at the end of April 1977, just after the end of his 100 days, with approval ratings between 71 and 75%. And now Obama, I believe, is peaking right now, even as we speak, basically in the same time frame, more or less, the same ballpark of a time frame, at substantially less, at just over 60%. So Obama already weaker than Carter. And Carter, of course, was somebody who got down into the mid-20s by the end of his abortive single-term presidency. Very likely that Obama will follow. Now, we're very pleased to be joined once again by a feature that we've sort of built into this program as a weekly necessity, and that's to hear from Phil Berg, that gallant crusading lawyer from Philadelphia who has been the one who took the lead in bringing these cases to the Supreme Court and the federal courts in general about the non-qualification of Obama to be president. Phil, are you there?
Yes, I am. How you doing?
Welcome, and we hope you're doing well. And why don't you give us the usual update about where we stand in the legal proceedings to try to assert the Constitution against this flimflam?
Well, I wish we were moving faster, but we are waiting now. First of all, this is the 10th month I've been involved in this. We're waiting word from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. They had given us a tentative date for argument at the end of this month, the last week of this month, first week in June. So we're waiting. That's on the issue of standing. That's a case we took up the Supreme Court, but they didn't hear it at that point, but they denied it because it was without judgment. We're back in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which is Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. Looks like oral argument is coming soon, which is a good sign. Hopefully, you know, we'll get some attention. Hopefully we need some judge to say, you know, I have standing, and also that discovery should go on the case. We have the second case, which is Hollister, the retired Air Force colonel, against Barry Soturo, a.k.a. Barack Hussein Obama. That case is now in the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia on the issue of the dismissal of the case and also on the sanctions by way of a reprimand the judge gave to our local counsel. The third case we have is under seal, and we're trying to get it unsealed, but we're still waiting patiently for a decision by the court. On top of that, we've had apologize to people who've been looking at our website, ObamaCrimes.com. My web person left us, and we now have someone new working on it. We should have the updates, but our website is really the best place to go. It has all the correct information about that. I'm not sure if I mentioned on the last show with you, but unfortunately I've had to file and the word's out now. We haven't really put a press release out because we're still waiting for the court on our application for a temporary restraining order, but I was forced to file a lawsuit against Orly Tates, the attorney from California. She is just, in my opinion, she's a loose cannon. Months ago, back in around December, I said I would not work with her because I didn't like her style. I didn't like what she was doing. And for the past couple of months, she has absolutely, I believe, lost it. But she's trying to take me down. I don't know why. I have the most prevalent cases in the whole of everyone out there right now. There's only one other attorney with a viable lawsuit going on. But I think Orly could be working for Obama or someone else because she's trying to take me down. She's admitted that, and she's trying to take me down through Lisa, who works for me. She has defiantly broken the law. We're waiting for the court where I had filed suit because what she has done is she's been dispersing, and she admits to doing it to like 25,000 people, and she's done it at least 6-7 times. The birth date and social security number of someone that works for me, that's blatantly a violation of the law. In California, there's a statute that states for every person that you distribute the social security number, the victim is entitled from you the sum of $3,000. Well, multiply 3,000 like 25,000 times like 6 or 7. Orly, she's really going crazy on this thing. And the day that she was served with a complaint, she did it again. She's just out and out trying to take us down, and I don't know why. What she just did the other day is like violates all the rules of ethics of an attorney. My sealed case, she has now published information regarding my sealed case, and I think that way she's trying to destroy my sealed case, and I'm not going to tolerate this, and waiting for the court to take some action against her. But people that think that, granted we should all be working together, but if people really look at what Orly's been doing, when she chased after and spoke to Chief Justice Roberts and also I think it was Justice Scalia, in effect she was getting these justices, which should be on the side to help us, the conservative side of the court, by confronting them at various meetings, she has put herself in a position where these justices can recuse themselves. Now, by publishing information regarding my sealed case, she's, in a way, trying to get my sealed case dismissed because you're not supposed to talk about something like that. So if people really take a look at it, After I filed my lawsuit on the retired Air Force Colonel Hollister, what does she do? She starts getting, not retired, now she has, but initially she starts getting service personnel who are active duty. That is frightening because, number one, they're not subjected to the same Article 3 courts that you and I are, not being in the service, and Article 3 courts in different states. In Pennsylvania would be Common Pleas Court, Superior Court, Commonwealth Court, and Supreme Court. Different states have different courts. When you're in the military, you're only subject to the military court system, so these individuals are now being subjected to a possible court-martial and or friendly fire. So if you really look what she's been doing, she's been grabbing a lot of publicity, yelling and screaming, but she has one lawsuit pending now, and I personally spoke to one of the plaintiffs, and they said that she doesn't even have authority for that lawsuit to be pending because they fired her from another action, and I'm talking about Wiley Drake. So, I don't know what's going on, but I ask the listeners here to go to my website, ObamaCrimes.com, spread my website around, and also if you can make a contribution, it's costly, and now with this lawsuit that I just had to file, which we're not raising money, someone else has contributed money for that lawsuit, but we're going after Orly, and I think her actions speak that she's trying to take down our efforts, even though she keeps trying to come across the people that she's trying to find out the truth of Obama. But by publishing this stuff on the sealed case recently and by doing these things, I think she's just, if you really look at what she's doing, it's just to get attention to her but also hurt our cause, because we have to raise the awareness to the people in this country who do not know this, and they don't want to hear nonsense. They don't want to hear BS. And that's why I've stayed focused, as you know, during this entire proceeding.
We're appalled by the chaos and disruption brought into this process by Orly Tates. I guess I have two questions. What possible reason does she have for revealing the Social Security number of one of your employees?
Nothing.
Does she offer any justification whatsoever for that? In what context does she do it?
No, she's doing it accusing this person of stealing money from me and stealing money from Orly and this
person.
That's
your business, not hers.
That's right. I mean, if someone is stealing money from me, write me a letter, tell me about it. Don't publish it all over the world. Everything she's doing now, I believe, is to hurt the cause. She's accused three or four different people of taking money, of hacking into her website and hacking into her PayPal account. We know that these are false statements, and we're going to continue our efforts.
Hang on, Phil. We'll get you back in just a second. A few more points that we'd like to cover.
Sure.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Here we are again with World Crisis Radio, Webster Topley in Washington, D.C., on the phone with Phil Berg, distinguished lawyer in Philadelphia. Phil, whenever you have an important effort like the one that you have been spearheading since August of last year before the Democratic National Convention, if somebody shows up late in the game and then seems to focus largely on attacking, criticizing other people who are part of the effort, then this allows us to draw certain conclusions. Could you just, for those who haven't followed the shenanigans of Orly Tates, could you maybe just sum up how she came into this and at what point and what it's looked like since then?
Well, I'm not sure. She showed up about November or December. She just showed up out of nowhere. She's a practicing dentist in California who, in the past number of years, I'm not sure, recently, though, received a law degree. And she came on, actually, with the Wiley Drake case out there, the Alan Keyes case, and then she burst on the national scene. She spoke with me, matter of fact, so it has to be November. We spoke together on December 8th, 2008, down at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and she spoke her bit, then she went off on some tangent. But, we all have different modus operandi. So I didn't think
anything. You mentioned the Drake case with Alan Keyes. Was there anything specific about that that's notable? I mean, what was the approach of that one?
It was in the – I'm not sure. And then she had another case called Lightfoot. I have to go back into it, but I really don't want to waste time on it. But recently she's done things, which I mentioned also. She has written a letter to the FBI and CIA. I mean, and she puts this information on her website asking them to go investigate the U.S. Supreme Court, saying shenanigans are going on there, that the clerk didn't provide records, her records, to the justices before a conference on her case. You know, the Supreme Court doesn't, you know, they're not playing games, and they might not want to hear the case for other reasons, but I'm sure they've had all the records here. And when she does these type things and gets the military people involved who are on active duty, putting their name and address out there, this doesn't appeal to the general public. You know, this is like when she says, I'm going to investigate the Supreme Court. You know, this doesn't help, in my opinion. So a lot's going on in this, and, you know, I'm just going to continue in my efforts to, I really didn't want to go file suit, but in a way, I had to, and I hope that the thrust of the public out there, you know, look at it a little bit, but I'd rather that case under seal because our efforts should stay focused on exposing Barack Obama. You mentioned something about, at the beginning, his, you know, where he stands in the polls and 4 years. I'm hoping he doesn't stay in office 4 years. I'm hoping that we can legally remove him from office because he's a usurper. He knows where he was born. He knows that this is the biggest hoax ever contemplated against the United States of America in 230 years. It's a total disgrace. He and Michelle and Howard Dean and other people who are aware of this hoax should be subjected to the criminal justice system, should be tried, and if convicted, should go to jail. I mean, it's really outrageous. So we have to make the public more aware of this. One of these days we're going to start soon some kind of additional thing. So that's why stay tuned to our website, Obama Crimes. We're going to come up to different ideas that people can help spread the word across this great nation. And hopefully the oral argument will get a definitive date on that. And hopefully the justices at this point, the judges in the Third Circuit, will do something. But no matter what it is, we're going to continue our efforts in every court. We were right now in 3 different courts, and we're going to keep pushing forward on this. So I can go on more and more things about it, really, but the thrust has to be not her. I don't know why she's doing these things, but to try to take me down just shows she's got an ulterior motive out there. And if you look back at what she's done, like right now she's running around the country giving out quo warranto cases to U.S. attorneys, to state attorneys, and to DAs. That's not the way to proceed on a quo warranto. And we'll get to that. We've just been swamped with other things.
So that's the other front, right? That's where you're planning to move in on a quo warranto by virtue of what document does he hold office?
Yeah, quo warranto just says you have no right to be in that office, and I believe that I know what she's doing on it is not the proper procedure. I just haven't had time to deal with it. But it could be her method running around the country doing these things is to turn people off. I mean, I have no idea what she's doing, but she, you know, even though she has a following here, it's not for good solid reasons. It really isn't.
Okay, it sounds like you're in demand, Phil. We want to thank you for being with us. We're looking forward to that case in the Third Circuit, right? We should try to get media to show up for that one.
That's right.
And you let us know in advance. In the meantime, it's ObamaCrimes.com, and Phil is always very shy. You got to give a contribution when you go there to keep this important work going. So we hope you can be with us next week and every week, Phil, because this is the most important front in the legal activities, and you are the pioneer. And you are the one who enjoys the confidence of the public and not some of these come-latelys.
Thank you. Let me just say one thing, too. I'm not doing this because I'm not trying. I could care less how Orly was proceeding, if she was proceeding in a good fashion, which she's not. I've said on your show and many shows, I don't care who crosses the finish line. I was the first guy with guts enough to file an action against Obama back on August 21st, 2008. And since then, many lawyers across this country have filed different actions. If someone else is able to legitimately get the information and can cross the finish line before me to get Obama legally out of office, I will support them 100%. But my efforts are to make sure that we expose Obama, and I'm doing everything in my power to do that, and everything on our website is directed that way. The money we raise is directed that way, and I will take out, you know, Orly takes, she'll get what she deserves. People know what's going on out there. I don't want to waste time on it, but I appreciate whoever out there will stay with me and take a look at what she's done if you really want to. And she has not done anything positive. She's hurting the cause. and we have to attract another 20, 30, 40 million people, and you can only do that going forth in a good manner, which I have attempted to do and I continue to do, and I appreciate your support.
Okay, Phil. We're always we're with you all the way on this, and we look forward to hearing from you again next week. Phil Berg of Philadelphia, and that's ObamaCrimes.com. Go there, keep informed, give a contribution, be part of this effort. We'll see you next week then.
Thank you.
So that's interesting. That's, of course, it's disturbing, but we know who has taken the lead in this, and it's Phil Berg. Now, let's just get back to our economics. We're going to talk about foreign policy now in the time remaining, but Herbert Hoover, we've just heard that Herbert Hoover was better than a lot of Austrians and Chicago monetarists of today, but he also... He's better than they are, also in the sense that he's a protectionist. The Republican Party was based on a high protective tariff, and a lot can be said in favor of it. So we'll get to that in just a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Thanks, as always, to Phil Berg. Now, Herbert Hoover, better than a lot of what you get today, because he is a supporter of a protective tariff, and he tells you that. He says in Washington, D.C., August 11th, 1932, this is the acceptance speech, the big one at the Republican convention. Herbert Hoover says, "I am squarely for a protective tariff. I am against the proposal of a competitive tariff for revenue as advocated by our opponents. This would place our farmers and our workers in competition with peasant and sweated labor products." In other words, products from a sweatshop. Then he goes to Des Moines, Iowa, which is the state he was from, October 4th, 1932. He says, "The Democratic platform," says Herbert Hoover, "enunciates the principle of a competitive tariff for revenue. The competition that is meant is peasant labor and cheap lands." And then he goes through for these farmers and he says, you know, "We could get butter outside the U.S. for 25% below your price, pork for 30% below your price, flaxseed 35% below, beans 40% below, wool 30% below. Corn and wheat could be sold in New York from Argentina at prices below yours." And he says, "I think the Democratic platform is a ghastly jest." But notice, in 1932, it's two kinds of tariff. It's not free trade and nothing more. Herbert Hoover says, we have the Republican Party tradition with McKinley and going back to Lincoln and Justin Morrill, a high protective tariff. The Democrats come in, this is Roosevelt now, with something, I think, inferior, a competitive tariff for revenue. But still, that's a significant tariff. Herbert Hoover says, 90% of the farm market is at home, and I propose to reserve this market for the American farmer. So he's going to defend the farmers with a protective tariff. That's much better than a lot of our free trade Austrian monetarists of today. Now, how is Hoover similar to Obama? He's similar to Obama in the sense of these bailouts. In his acceptance speech, August 11th, 1932, Washington, D.C., Herbert Hoover talks about the National Credit Association, whose efforts prevented the failure of hundreds of banks, and above all, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation with $2 billion. That's approximately 1 year's federal budget, so it's more or less comparable to what you have today. It's within an order of magnitude. The Reconstruction Finance Corporation, says Hoover, with a capital of $2 billion to uphold the credit structure of the nation, and by thus raising the shield of government credit, We prevented the wholesale failure of banks, of insurance companies, building and loan associations, farm mortgage associations, livestock loan associations, and the railroads in which all of the public interest, in all of them, the public interest is paramount. We have averted disaster by preventing the bankruptcy of 5,000 banks. The problem is, of course, that this didn't work. Herbert Hoover, in the summer of 1932, is in a moment of calm in the descent into the Depression, and that is going to change because later in 1932 and then into the beginning of 1933, you're going to get this huge banking crisis, which eventually shuts down through panic runs every single bank. Hoover, in his acceptance speech, also talked about using the powers of the Federal Reserve banks to counteract the stupendous shrinkage of credit due to fear, hoarding, and to foreign withdrawals. Well, eventually he couldn't do anything about that. So very similar between Obama and Herbert Hoover. The TARP, the bailout, is essentially the Reconstruction Finance Corporation of Herbert Hoover on a somewhat larger scale, but not a hugely large scale, and it's doomed to futility and failure in precisely the same way. Now, how is Herbert Hoover better? Well, he's got some things going on. He's building Boulder Dam. He's building a great work, an indispensable work of infrastructure, and he's fighting for the St. Lawrence Seaway, something we don't talk about too much in public policy, but a canal system so that you can bring ocean-going vessels into the Great Lakes. This is an absolutely critical thing. It's a modernization of the same principle as the Erie Canal. Herbert Hoover is somebody who says, let's build the St. Lawrence Seaway with the international treaty with Canada, using the St. Lawrence River. So Herbert Hoover is quantitatively better than Obama in the sense that he has some kind of a concept of great projects of infrastructure, same way that Eisenhower, even though he's a Republican, can still understand the need for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration or for the interstate highway system that he built. Now, let's switch gears very quickly now and go to foreign policy. We're now in the midst of the soup. I think foreign policy situation now very ominous. In the past couple of weeks, we've had here the visit of President Karzai of Afghanistan, President Zardari of Pakistan. And if you look at the mighty Wurlitzer out there, the controlled Wall Street media, you can easily see that they are now whipping up opinion for some kind of an escalated adventure in that part of the world. Obama is escalating the U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan. It's going to be 65,000 to 70,000 U.S. forces plus a significant number of NATO forces in Afghanistan. The Taliban is on the march in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and this is the kind of war where the imperialists usually take it on the chin, right? This is the Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires, Russian Empire defeated, British Empire defeated, Soviet Empire defeated there too. It's just a place that's impossible to occupy, but these utopians want to try it again. And just in the past week, it's clear that Obama is going to emerge as the owner of the Pakistan war. Iraq and Afghanistan, those were Bush's wars. Pakistan is Obama's war. Naturally, the foundation-funded peace movement is worse than useless on this. MoveOn.org, I think, supports the escalation of the war in Afghanistan. But remember, Afghanistan is simply a way to pursue the breakup of Pakistan. The goal of this is the destruction of the unified Pakistani national state. It's the process of splintering in the Indian subcontinent, right? They're basically a policy of secessionism, microstates, mini-states. In this case, the microstates and mini-states might be called Balochistan, Pashtunistan, Waziristan, and Sindh, and a couple of other little ones. So they want to shatter Pakistan, the goal being to prevent the emergence of a Pakistani energy corridor going from Iran to China, with the idea that if you build the proper pipelines, you could be delivering oil from Iran to China without having to go through the oceans, which are going to be controlled by the Anglo-Americans. You stay on the land and you make the interdiction, blackmail, interference, sabotage, and so forth so much harder. Now, in the meantime, we've got a new general, General McKiernan, the commander of the U.S. forces in Afghanistan, has now been ousted. This is actually not a very common event. The commander of a combat theater, a theater commander in the midst of what I guess has to be considered a war, ousted. And the new guy, General McChrystal. Now, McChrystal is a utopian. He is a special forces guy, and his specialization is to go after and kill high-value targets. Now, in some ways, this is a charade. It's a cover story. We're going to be told, oh, McChrystal is this guy. He just has this killer instinct. He wants to go and find Osama bin Laden, and nothing will stop him. So therefore, he's going to start running amok, not just in Afghanistan, of course, but in northwest Pakistan, in the federally administered tribal areas, alias Waziristan. So that's going to be a recipe for disaster and defeat for the United States. Back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Radio, Webster Topley here in Washington, D.C., looking at the foreign policy dossier. Escalation on the agenda in Pakistan. Obama's war against Pakistan is ongoing now. We have these predator drone attacks basically all the time. The most recent incident, 140 Pakistani civilians killed in cold blood by a predator drone run by the Obama regime. This is not Bush anymore. It's not Rumsfeld. This is Obama, and this is Gates, the tool of Brzezinski, owes his career to his big new Brzezinski. 9 Pakistanis, civilians, killed also. So some of these casualties are also in, I guess it's 140 in Afghanistan and 9 in Pakistan. 140 killed in Afghanistan, 9 in Pakistan. The goal, again, is to rile up the Taliban, the other warlords, get them going, and then to export the conflict as fast as possible into Pakistan. That is the goal of this operation. And the new guy, McChrystal, the new theater commander, a special forces utopian, specialized in killing high-value targets, will be turned loose under the story, right, the media narrative that this guy is going to go after Obama at the cave where he lives, and that will mean running amok in Pakistan, violating sovereignty, and setting up some kind of a huge crisis in that part of the world. So that's bad enough. But now let's look over to Georgia. Here, of course, the potential is even greater because we've got a first-class nuclear power, i.e. Russia, on the other side of the Ossetian line. These maneuvers by NATO are highly provocative. They are an act of insanity, and they're ongoing right now. Here we are in the middle of May. These maneuvers go on in various forms until June 1st. So the Russians have protested this NATO provocation. And we've just had this interesting thing, a brigade of 500 Georgian troops mutinied on the eve of the maneuvers and tried to pull a coup. They tried to overthrow the fascist dictator Saakashvili, the NATO IMF puppet ruling in Tiflis. They tried to overthrow him. They didn't get very far. And then the Georgians are accusing Russia of being involved. Naturally, there's a huge mobilization of opposition political forces inside Georgia against Saakashvili. There's a Russian security memorandum that looks forward to nothing but conflict with NATO, despite Barky Obama's smiling face. They see a NATO threat, first of all, in NATO expansionism, that is to say, into Georgia, into Ukraine, into other areas where color revolutions might be staged. And they also see a possibility of conflict over the Arctic region because of the oil and natural gas. So that's Georgia. There's a third theater. We've now got the Pakistani, Afghan, India theater. We've got the Georgia theater, Russian border area. Now let's look at the Middle East. King Abdullah of Jordan puts out a statement saying that if we don't get a peace settlement in the Middle East within the next 12 to 18 months with a two-state solution for the Palestinians, we're going to have war between 1 and 1.5 years in the future, a Middle East war. Now, somehow all of this I find suspicious. We got to sort of brainstorm a little bit and see what all this might mean, as we're now changing gears into something new. Netanyahu, the demagogic prime minister of Israel, is constantly vociferating with the help of his thuggish sidekick, Avigdor Lieberman, that they are going to attack Iran and they won't tolerate Iran and all that. We've had reports in the last 48 hours that Obama has sent a private message to Netanyahu saying, back off, do not attack Iran. Now, this is the message coming from Mullen at the Joint Chiefs of Staff over the last year or more. We've also got Secretary of Defense Gates over at the Pentagon saying, don't attack Iran. There would be a disastrous backlash against this in the future. We've also just had the visit of Pope Benedict the 16th in the Holy Land in Israel and Palestine, and a lot of attention on Iran as part of this. We've also got to remember always Biden's speech in Seattle, Washington on October 19th of last year, when he said, within the first 6 months of the Obama regime, we're going to have a major international crisis which will be generated. Now, what could this all mean? How could this all fit together? We have very good reason to believe that there's a U.S. deal with Iran, that indeed there has been a U.S. deal with Iran for quite a while. This is the basis of the pacification of the southern Iraq war front. And in other words, all those Muqtada Sadr people, all those Iraqi Shiites seem to be calming down, have calmed down, under the influence of the mullahs of Iran. It looks like a deal was made between the U.S. and the Iranians already. Now, we've just had the case of this woman journalist, U.S.-Iranian joint citizen arrested, accused of spying and whatever, but then let go. She arrived in Vienna now. This is the kind of stuff that is often used as a cover for some kind of a rapprochement. And I would actually urge people, look back to Munich in 1938. Remember that the Munich conference, the sellout of Czechoslovakia to Hitler, had been preceded by a series of other conferences. There was one at Bad Godesberg and one another one. Chamberlain, of course, and Daladier were looking for ways to build up Hitler, to turn him east, to use him against the Soviets. And there's an interesting book by an American historian, William Schumann, from one of the small liberal arts colleges in Massachusetts, Williams, I think, who he talks about a pre-Munich plot. In other words, looks like there's a peace deal between Hitler and Chamberlain. Everything seems to be taken care of. But then there's another meeting, and Hitler says, now that none of that is good enough. I want more concessions, and the world is filled with the danger of immediate war. And that's the moment when Chamberlain really terrifies the British population by giving out gas masks, building trenches, digging trenches in the parks in London, and otherwise giving these poor people the idea that war is about to break out. The goal of it is to prepare British public opinion for the complete sellout of Czechoslovakia and make them accept it without bringing down the Chamberlain government, Tory conservatives, to keep Chamberlain in power so he can go on to bigger and better deals with Hitler, again, turning Hitler east, get rid of him by playing him off against Stalin. something like this possibly in the works. Suppose we had a situation where Netanyahu gives some kind of an ultimatum. Let's say we get a 72-hour ultimatum by Israel to Iran. Stop all centrifuges, stop all enrichment of uranium, stop all construction of your nuclear reactors. And then we could have an orchestrated war scare around the world. And then somehow Obama could come on the scene as a peace angel and arrange peace in our time based on some package of concessions that would be more, this might be done for the benefit of Israeli public opinion, U.S., European, we need to work out the details, but some kind of a stunt involving what Biden has told us about could very well be in the offing. So we want to watch that quite carefully and remember the thesis of the pre-Munich plot that may somehow enlighten our path as we go along. So remember, Surviving the Cataclysm, your guide to the worst financial crisis in human history, from www.progressivepress.com. And those who have ordered it, please be patient. The paper copies will be arriving, and we'll see you next week right here.